All right. Hello, everyone. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation to speak. I apologize that I have to head out tomorrow. It is my last class of the semester on Thursday, and skipping classes is cool, but I felt obliged to be there for the last one, so I have to head out.
That's the one where they give their opinion of you.
That's right, exactly, and I need to be there. So today I'm going to tell you about some cosmological questions and maybe also a wish list for G2 compactifications at large N. Hopefully my slides are up to your standards, but if they're not, it's because of this little gentleman in the right over here last night that is the mascot for my undergraduate university, and we won the national basketball championship last night, so I was distracted for a few hours that I did not expect to be. Dave pointed out this is a victory V, not a touchdown sign, which is... well, more relevant for basketball. So this, what I'm going to tell you today is not about any one project. The basic idea is to take some of the things that we've been learning in F-theory that might be relevant for cosmology and try to ask, I don't think we can necessarily answer the questions yet, but try to ask whether similar sorts of things arise in G2 compactifications. The things that I'm going to be talking about today are in some sense at large N, and I'll try to explain throughout what I mean by that. So this work, what I'm telling you about today, is influenced heavily by a number of you in the audience, and also in particular collaborations of mine with Cody Long, Dave, Brent Nelson, Fabian Rula, Gustavo Salinas, my student Ben Sung, and Wadi Taylor. So today I want to tell you some of the lessons that occur at large N in F-theory and try to ask whether or not those things plausibly happen in G2 compactifications, because I think that those things are interesting from a cosmological perspective. I recognize that a lot of the audience does not have a broad background in cosmology, and so I'll try to explain some of the essentials, but there are also places where I'll just try to say this is the sort of data in G2 compactifications that you would need to start thinking about some of these questions. So some of the lessons that we've had thus far is that at large N in Calabi-Yau manifolds, Calabi-Yau compactifications of string theory or M theory, we often end up with many, many so-called axion-like particles, and I'll tell you what those are. They're particles that are associated with appropriate topological cycles of appropriate dimensions, depending on the details, and also large gauge sectors. Gauge groups in the low-energy theory whose structure is dictated by geometry, and furthermore, that seem to get forced on you in a way that you might consider what it means from a cosmological perspective. So most of the known landscape, known is always sort of in quotes and a sticky word, but most of what we currently know about string compactifications or M-theory compactifications lives at large N in some sense. So for instance, there are so-called flux vacua it's believed that most of them are at large H21 in Calabi-Yau compactifications. And furthermore, there's F-theory bases where generally they are very complex with many, many distinct topological cycles. So the biggest questions we just can't plausibly answer these days, the sort of question that one would like to ask is, if what sort of cosmological mechanism is or is not selecting certain types of theories and geometries in string theory? So for instance, if cosmology picks generic bases or flux vacua as we currently understand them, what you would expect to find is large gauge sectors and many axions. The thing is that there's a big caveat. First, we don't know the totality of what string theory is or how to think about it in cosmological contexts yet. The other is that even if that were a possibility, it could be that the right dynamics in string theory, the one that actually arises, could be sharply peaked away from large N, so that you would end up selecting geometries and physical setups that are just in a different context. And in that case, these considerations wouldn't apply. So in particular, this is something that a discussion I like to have with friends somewhat regularly, but Deneff, Douglas, Green, and Zukowski put out an idea about a year ago about how ideas from computational complexity might govern dynamics and give you a reason to expect that less topological complexity is what you should expect in string theory. And there are analogies to protein folding and spin glasses there that are interesting. But these are the caveats. So in some sense, I just want to ask, what is it that we see at large N? Do similar sorts of things arise in G2 compactifications? And if that's what we're getting in string theory and And that's what is selected cosmologically. How does it force us to think about cosmology in a way that's different from ways that model builders might think about it, for instance? Okay. So broadly, the question is, do the lessons that we learn in Calabi-Yau apply in G2? And in G2 compactifications, large N for me means large B3. Okay. So that's what I mean. Yeah, so there are many, many possible vacua that one could potentially have in string theory, and there are different mechanisms that people have studied over the years for selecting one type of vacuum versus another. We don't know which mechanism is the correct mechanism, but in some sense, how it is that the dynamics in the early universe would pick one possibility or another would be something that would dramatically affect the physical result. So this is a case where we don't know the right answer for what the dynamics is, but one would like to have some sort of understanding of what dynamics is selecting certain possibilities over others. Yeah. Okay, so the outline of my talk is to tell you first about large gauge sectors. These are cases where the gauge group of the low energy theory is a product group of many simple Lie groups. In G2 compactifications, if these sorts of things existed, you would have many ADE singularities on many different 3 manifolds throughout the G2 geometry. I don't think that there are such known examples yet, but I want to ask the question by analogy to F theory. Then there is something called an axion, and there's an idea of asymmetric reheating. The basic idea there is that in the early universe, you can have a field that dominates the energy density of the universe. It's commonly called the inflaton. That does one sort of thing. More generally, one might call it a reheaton. And it's a field that dumps its energy density into many different sectors. And whether or not the cosmology is viable depends critically on this process that's called reheating that a number of people are studying these days, including people in the audience. And I'll try to explain that, and I'll try to explain what G2 data. I realize I'm going to have to just tell you many things and say this is this interesting thing, but I'll also try to tell you what G2 data is relevant for actually computing some of these things. You know, if I gave you a wish list, what would be on it? And finally, I'll tell you a little bit about axion-photon couplings and experiments. This is something I've gotten more interested in recently. I think it's really cool. A downside of it is that our first results aren't ready yet. I was really hoping they would be, but I think it's interesting enough that I want to tell you about it, even though I don't have results yet. So some goals for each of these sections is to explain the origin and the relevance of large N, to give some G2 context and ask some questions and maybe ask for a wish list there, and also to convey why it is that some physicists at least care about these issues. In each section, I'm going to try to give you an outline there, too, because there's sort of a lot of ideas here that might be new to you. So first, when I discuss large gauge sectors, I want to tell you about a type of Calabi-Yau compactification called F-theory, where I'm going to introduce a notion of a non-Higgsable cluster. This is the large gauge sector that is arising in these geometries. I'll talk about ensembles of string compactifications, of F-theory compactifications, and how these large gauge sectors arise. And then I'll push towards what these would look like in G2 manifolds and ask questions there. Some of them actually do exist due to work of Sakura and Andy. They argued for them by string duality, and in twisted connected sums argued how it is that you have these singularities that you can't get rid of by G2 deformations. And then I'll pose some questions for cosmology. So F-theory is a strongly coupled regime that generalizes type 2b that many people in the audience have worked on for a long time. The geometry is actually critical in this setup, and this is where the connection to G2 manifolds potentially comes in. So the geometry is we have some flat space that I'll just take to be R31 times an elliptic Calabi-Yau fourfold Y4. And canonically, we put this in Weierstrass form. One of the reasons that we do this is due to a theorem of Nakayama. It's also just practically very easy to deal with. And this Weierstrass form is a hypersurface equation of this form y squared is x cubed plus fx plus g, where f and g are sections of appropriate line bundles on the base of the fibration. And the upshot here is that we have these geometric setups, and you could ask questions like, for a fixed B3, what is the most generic Weierstrass model over it, and ask what the physics is there, and that's one of the things that we'll do. But the key thing is that the geometry dictates structures of the brain physics. So there's a discriminant locus, 4f cubed plus 27g squared equals 0, and that is the locus, it's a divisor in the base above which the elliptic fiber collapses. Physically, this is where the brains are located, and so when we talk about gauge groups coming from F theory, what we're often talking about is these discriminant loci in the base where the elliptic fiber collapses, and the details of the collapsed fiber dictates the structure of the brain and what simple Lie group you get on the brain. Then there's something that won't be that relevant for the talk called G-flux. It's relevant for chirality and moduli stabilization, but for the purposes of this talk, I think it's just better to leave it out. But there it is. Then there's the idea of a non-Higgsable cluster that many people in the audience have worked on extensively. This is something pushed especially far by Dave and Wadi Taylor in a series of papers since about 2012. It's something that I've found to be very interesting myself, partially because it's not the picture that I expected string theory to give, and that's just because my expectations were too naive. And I've gotten interested in what does it mean if this sort of picture is true. So the basic story is that this Weierstrass model, which will be featured throughout, this y squared is x cubed plus fx plus g, if I hand you a fixed base for the elliptic vibration, you can ask, if I can write down the most generic polynomial, most generic global section f and g, is it true that there are coordinates, for example, in toric varieties, homogeneous coordinates, that are forced to factorize for generic complex structure? What that would mean is that no matter what you do, if you consider the most generic space of Fs and Gs, their zero loci are reducible varieties. In most cases, it means that the total space of the elliptic vibration is itself singular, and in many cases, this sort of factorization structure forces non-trivial Kodaira fibers and gauge groups on you. The physics picture, for those that are more familiar with this picture, is that we learn in string theory 101 that if you stack n brains on top of each other, you get, in the most generic case, a UN gauge theory, and then the process of moving the brains apart is a process that Higgses the gauge group. Some might call it brain splitting, and that brain splitting process is a process that Higgses the gauge group. What this is saying here is that from the math perspective, for generic complex structure, no matter what you do, there is some irreducible gauge group that you cannot possibly brain split. So that's why it has this name non-Higgsable cluster, or more precisely, sometimes in the literature, geometrically non-Higgsable cluster. There is no complex structure deformation that Higgses the gauge group. In six dimensions, physically, this is very well understood. The reason that you can't Higgs the gauge group is because either you have super Yang-Mills or you have not enough matter to Higgs on. So we fully understand what is happening with non-Higgsable gauge groups in six dimensions. In four dimensions, there's another piece of the puzzle that can come in, which is called the superpotential. And this can also provide obstructions in your moduli space that can forbid you from Higgsing. So that's currently what we understand, and there's some open questions still. But at the end of the day, what you end up with, if I hand you a fixed base, you can ask how many factors do I have coming out of this F and G. Those zero loci of those factors are components of the discriminant locus along which I have some simple Lie group. The simple Lie groups geometrically are constrained to lie in this set, E87, E6, F4, D4, B3, G2, A2, and A1. Okay. So it's just the fact that when you understand this basic mechanism and the Kodaira classification, you can just look up what the possibilities are. Interestingly, if you have the zero locus of one of these brains and you encircle it, the inverse image in the elliptic vibration at a point here, for instance, is a smooth elliptic fiber. But as you go around, it'll feel a Picard-Lefschetz monodromy. It'll be SL2Z, and in particular, the SL2Z monodromies associated with all of these non-Higgsable clusters are, when raised to some power k, are unity.
Yeah. You should go counterclockwise.
Should I?
Yeah.
What?
In complex analysis, to get the correct orientation.
Ah, yes, the standard. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. It's a picture. Good. Thanks, Dave. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so to agree with common conventions, I should go the other way. Yeah, good, thanks. Okay, so this is this picture. The idea is that if I hand you a base, you can just do this computation, compute what a generic Weierstrass model looks like, study the irreducible components that make up the reducible discriminant locus, and see what the physics is. A rule of thumb that is pretty good in six dimensions and a little worse in four dimensions is that this sort of behavior arises when the base is not weak phono. Remember that an algebraic variety is weak phono if minus k dot c is greater than or equal to 0 for all holomorphic curves c. And basically, this is one way of understanding what's happening with non-Higgsable clusters. It's not the exact condition, but it sort of maps onto sorts of things that mathematicians might study. So for example, there are 105, if I remember the number, deformation families of Fano threefolds. Is that the right number? Does that sound right? It's something like that. And the point being that as you sort of start to drop this Fano condition and go to weak Fano and then eventually go to the just not weak Fano case where there is some holomorphic curve that dots to something negative with minus k, you're sort of going into broader and broader spaces. So in the toric case, if I restrict to bases of the fibration that are toric twofolds, there are 16 toric twofold weak Fanos. None of them give rise to this structure where the factorization is forced on you and you end up with non-trivial components of the discriminant locus. But in work by Dave and Wadi, they abandoned that assumption and found 65,000 torics or something like that. All of them force this extra structure on you except those 16 that were precisely the weak Fanos. From a three-dimensional perspective, if we consider a three-dimensional base, which is the relevant thing for four-dimensional compactifications of F-theory, which you care about for obvious physics reasons, you can do the same sort of thing. So for the weak Fanos, one famous one is P3, of course, CP3. But there are 4,318 more different reflexive polytopes that when you do fine regular star triangulations of them, can be related each one to a weak Fano, smooth weak Fano toric variety. Toric threefold. And the estimate is that there's order 10 to the 15 of those. Okay. So if you start to abandon this weak Fano assumption, what you regularly have, just like in Dave and Wadi's case when they were doing 2D torics, when you abandon this assumption, you very quickly have non-Higgsable clusters forced on you. There's a nice paper by Wadi Taylor and Yinan Wang. Their estimate is that basically what they do is they start with P3 and then they just do tons of toric blowups from there. And so they sort of explore this space out away from P3, in each case studying the F-theory compactification over that geometry, then doing more blowups, F-theory compactification, elliptic vibration over that geometry, and so forth. Their estimate is that there's 10 to the 3,000 such bases, generically, and they'll give you numbers of what that means. They find in their ensemble that these non-Higgsable clusters are just there. And in Trion, in a different ensemble, which is something that my group studied a few years ago, we have a construction algorithm that does toric blowups in a similar way. I'll mention more about it. But the upshot there is that there's 10 to the 755 possibilities. And the physics is that if you random sample this geometry, the number of these axions that I'll tell you about is 1883 plus or minus 29. The rank of the gauge group from these irreducible components is 1609 plus or minus 17. And the number of different gauge group factors, if you write G1 times dot, dot, dot times Gn, the number of factors is 762 plus or minus 11. Okay. Yeah, when you random sample our ensemble. Yep. Average values and standard deviation. So in this case, we just have the exact construction algorithm. So we have a sampling algorithm. The bias that's introduced there is the fact that we believe that Wadi's number is probably closer to the truth, and we don't know how our bias relates to what they find. Yeah. In our sample, it's just sampling it from a flat distribution because we have an exact combinatoric constructive algorithm. The bias comes in how it fits into the bigger ensembles. And I don't have something useful to say there. Yeah. Pardon? The number of gauge group factors, so G1 times dot, dot, dot times Gn, n is 762 in this ensemble, on average. That's right. That's right. So part of the question with all of this is how do these ensembles fit inside the full set of possibilities? And that's not something that I don't think anyone has a good grasp on. I think the thing to do that would really be to compare what Wadi finds, which is probably more general, with what we find where we can do exact combinatoric constructions. Yeah.
And what's the energy scale for each of these numbers? This is all about the stream scale?
Yeah.
How many of them can find, how many of them break?
That depends on details like turning on G-flux, for instance, as you know. And in particular, whether or not they confine doesn't depend on that, but the confinement scale is going to depend critically on Kähler moduli stabilization, and we're not factoring that in at this point.
So what should I think of this number? You're not talking about G-flux, maybe something that's very important for getting the physics out.
Yeah, it could break it down. This is, think of, this is the what the geometry gives you. This is the geometrically non-Higgs-Abel gauge group. It could be broken down by fluxes, and that is subject to constraints like flux quantization and tuple cancellation and so forth.
Do you have an estimate for what it does to these numbers?
No, I wish I did. Part of the thing that's hard there is, first of all, that doing the resolutions that you would normally need to do to blow up something with 700 different singularities is a non-trivial calculation. The other thing that I worry about is that you're going to be in one of these cases where you have these terminal singularities where there is no Krepent resolution. That is something that could arise here. We haven't looked into it too much. It's a good question. Yeah. You could break it down. So like this picture could fail if you can turn on tons of fluxes and just break everything down. But there's usually constraints on how much flux you can turn on, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, what if I gave like a million SUN gauge theory gauge group and n equals 1 CCD? It'd all be gone by the time I'm done with it.
Why? Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're talking about confinement, then yes. In the deep IR, they will confine. And part of the cosmologies we're going to consider have confinement built in as one of the possibilities. Yeah, absolutely. So John's pointing out that depending on the details of the gauge dynamics, at low energies, you can have cases where it doesn't look like you have any gauge group. And in particular, there's a spectrum of particles associated with that confinement that can be relevant. Yeah, this is the UV theory. So the ensemble is the following. So just to be a little more precise, the starting point, we're considering 4D F theory. The geometries are elliptic vibrations over bases B. The gauge structure is determined by the topology of the base. This thing's called it gives rise to these things called non-Higgs-Abel clusters. So the starting point of our construction, and I'll give a picture in a second that makes it a little more clear, is a weak Fano toric threefold encoded in a certain triangulation that's fine, regular, and star of a three-dimensional reflexive polytope. We do topological transitions from there by systematically performing sequences of toric blowups along toric curves and points. And these sequences are bounded. So if all singularities are canonical, the geometry that the transition is done from is at finite distance in complex structure moduli space. This is some results from the 90s, I believe, by Hayakawa and Wang. And Dave has discussed this in F-theory in various places. I don't know if it's in one specific place right now. But anyways, given this idea of canonical singularities being at finite distance, you can classify given particular sequences of toric blowups and toric blowups over curves and points that satisfy a sufficient condition for canonical singularities. And what this ensemble is all ways of performing those sequences of blowups from an initial fixed triangulated polytope. So the picture, if you'd like, is this. I have this big three-dimensional reflexive polytope here that's on the left. This big face, this big facet up here is on the right-hand side of the board triangulated. And the basic picture is that any one of these sequences of toric blowups over points can be represented by a widget like this that you can put on any one of those triangles in the triangulation. A sequence of blowups over a toric curve can be represented by one of these widgets here that you can put on any one of those edges in the triangulation. It turns out there's 82 objects of this type, and there's 41 million objects of this type. And then when you take into account the fact that this polytope has many, many edges and many, many toric curves and points that you can do these sequences of blowups over, you get a very large number. And this is the exact this is the exact lower bound on the size of the ensemble. So this is this picture. It's basically just toric geometry. It's relatively simple, but by having ways of doing these blowups very systematically, we can construct and study a large ensemble. Okay, so this is the point where if I get this wrong, my friends in the audience can tell me. So non-Higgs-Abel clusters, it's interesting to ask this structure that we have in 6D F3 compactifications and in 4D F3 compactifications on elliptic threefolds and elliptic fourfolds, do we get similar sorts of things in G2 constructions or not? To my knowledge, there is exactly one paper that addresses this issue. It's a paper by Andy and Sakura. Let me remind you that the twisted connected sum construction, we have K3 fibered building blocks on the two different sides here. K3 fibered building block, K3 fibered building block times a circle. And then, of course, the construction is that the circles get swapped in the neck. And we have these asymptotically cylindrical CY3s times a circle that get glued together in this way by a particular hyperkähler rotation that induces a matching condition. And this is the twisted connected sum construction that you all know very well. So in the context of the non-Higgs-Abel clusters, this is Andy and Sakura's result that they understand from other points of view via string duality, and that's part of the very nice check that they have, is that your building block K3 fiber has in its Picard lattice some resolved, some lattice of some resolved ADE singularity. And that's what you have in this picture here that I tried to communicate. Here's like the resolved S2 of an A1 singularity. But when you impose the matching condition forces the Kähler form to integrate to zero on the curves of the ADE resolution. And so what you end up with in the construction is a singularity that you can't get rid of. Basically, it's the matching condition that is forcing it to collapse down. So what these examples that they have are some sort of G2 spaces that are singular, but there is no deformation. There is no deformation of the G2 space that will get rid of that singularity. I don't know if you guys want to say more or not, but that hits it on the head. Good. We can say more, but that's the crux. Yeah. Yes. Sure.
If the only singularity you have in your G2 manifold are codimension 4,
yes,
ADE singularities,
yes,
then the non-integral cluster thing, I mean, the only thing basically it says that B, for it to be non-integral, it means B1 of
yes.
All the three
yes.
Is zero, so every locus
that's right. You're engineering pure super Yang Mills in this case, and pure super Yang Mills from a physics perspective is one case that's just definitely non-Higgsable. So any G2 space that engineers that gauge theory will be non-Higgsable, and those are exactly the sorts of cases that, at least in some cases, they found. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right, so the simplest case would be D term or F term obstructions from superpotential or just from not having enough matter to Higgs on. Oh, do you have examples with matter? They're all super Yang Mills. Yeah. But in principle, there's no reason that you can't have matter where there's an F term and D term obstruction that forbids you from Higgsing, as you know.
In some sense, the possibilities that you have there are similar to what you can do in F theory.
Yeah.
So it'll be non-chiral.
Yeah, it will be non-chiral.
You could also have a non-Higgsable chiral gauge theory. That's a perfectly fine thing. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's like 60 F theory, no?
Yeah. I agree, but it's hard to engineer this way.
Oh, yeah, that's true. This way, it's very, yeah, not in their case. Yeah, very good. So, right, so some related questions, some of which have already been addressed. So if these things exist in G2 with some degree of generality, I mean, we know they exist in a few cases in TCS for sure. They're singular with no smoothing G2 deformation. That is, you can't Higgs the theory from a physical perspective. What can be said about these? Anything beyond TCS? And these questions will appear on a slide at the end, so don't worry about, just take them as some motivation for now. Any reason to expect that these are common at large N, which is equal to large B3? So for instance, you might ask, do they emerge as we do more and more topological transitions in G2 moduli space to larger B3? This would be the analog of what's happening in the Calabi-Yau case, where as you do topological transitions in the base of the elliptic vibrations, you're sort of increasingly likely to end up with these structures forced on you. And what's the physics of those transitions, for instance? That would be 60 analogs of some of the things we know in six dimensions. So there are some questions for cosmology that I'll be a little brief in the interest of time. Basically, we have this picture that's emerged that the atoms that make up us are 4.6% of the energy density in the universe. Dark matter is 24% of it, so the matter that makes up us is only 20% of the matter that's out there. The rest is dark matter. Dark energy is 71.4%, and one of the places we know some of this information from is cosmic microwave background experiments like Planck, which is currently the highest precision experiment. So cosmology is a precise science, of course, about the evolution of the universe. There's important open questions, but it also gives constraints on your theories that you have to take seriously. So for instance, in this case, you might say, we've got all these gauge sectors. Can those be dark matter? So it turns out that you can motivate effective field theories using that scenario that work, but they can also lead to problems where you just produce too much dark matter. And because you could, in principle, have some component of dark matter from any one of these sectors, this problem, in a sense, at least if you were just to, yeah, this problem becomes worse as the number of gauge sectors goes up, roughly. But that's all I'm going to say about it now. So these are the sorts of cosmological questions that you might ask. So this motivates study of something different. So we have this one story that we're talking about, which is in G2 manifolds, are we in G2 singular spaces, are we getting the analog of these non-Higgsable clusters, which would be many collections of three manifolds with ADE singularities and particularly potentially some extra singularity enhancements also. That's one sort of structure that might emerge. But I also want to ask about these axions and axion-like particles. So first I need to tell you about the origins of axions. I need to give you some information about how they arise in Calabi-Yau and G2 and give you some examples. I'll mention briefly some aspects of axion cosmology and then focus in on something called reheating that is very important for cosmology. And I'll ask some of the questions in G2 and then ask a question also about axion masses at large n. Okay, so theories with extra dimensions often have higher form gauge fields. So in some of physicists' favorite examples, these are the 10 and 11 dimensional supergravity theories. The context for how axions arise is that we have some space that's R31 times some manifold X, and we have our higher p-form gauge field that I'm writing as CP that we decompose as wedge products of forms of, well, in this case, dimension P. There could be other decompositions also, but the idea is that theta is a function only of coordinates on R31, and omega is some harmonic form on X, the manifold. And so Kaluza-Klein reduction in this case gives rise to 4D fields, these theta I's. After you integrate CP over the extra dimensions, you'll end up with these four-dimensional fields that can arise and be important physically. There's a gauge symmetry of this form that induces a shift symmetry on the axions. That's important physically also. But the basic upshot is that for each, given a p-form gauge field in a higher dimensional theory, for each p cycle, there's going to be one of these low energy fields, theta I, and these are important. So in some sense, the topological complexity, by which I mean the number of distinct topological cycles, is something like the number of axions. These fields, theta, are the objects of interest that are called axions or axion-like particles. So in Calabi-Yau and G2, so for example, there's three different types of axions that arise in type 2b. But in M-theory on G2, we would be getting these from the three form of 11-dimensional supergravity integrated over three cycles. This is the imaginary part of a complexified G2 modulus, which is something that physicists want to think about. And in ensembles, we can ask what sorts of expectations do we have. So this is just shamelessly stolen from Joyce's book, this plot on the right. And you can see that there are examples where B3 is getting up to be 30, up to 150, and the highest is up there at like 210 or 190 or something like that. So in those cases, those numbers I just quoted would be the number of axions that you get in the low energy theory, and they can be important. Similarly, in Calabi-Yau, on a Hodge plot, you can, depending on the string theoretic context, you can read off how many axions you have for any given fixed geometry, and the numbers are going to be dozens or hundreds or something like that. In the tree ensemble, the number is more like 1,800, but the point is there are many of these things, and we should take them seriously. Axion cosmology. It's relevant for a lot of things. It's relevant for the inflationary phase potentially in the early universe that drives the exponential expansion of space. We're going to talk about reheating today. It could be relevant for dark matter. It could be relevant for something called dark radiation. The basic idea in the minds of some people is that a single string compactification could have many axions and therefore realize many of these possibilities. Some people call this the axiverse. So let me try to explain reheating and what is relevant here and physically and how it would arise in G2. So if you have a field that comes to dominate the energy density of the universe early in the universe, this is a standard framework that people think in cosmology. The question is, if you have this field that carries all of this energy and you have many different gauge sectors that could have different particle species in them, how is it that the field that carries this energy dumps some energy into sector 1 versus sector 2 versus sector n? So the picture that we have here is that the reheton is carrying all of this energy, and it could potentially dump energy into G1, G2, Gn. But whether it does or not, there's many couplings it can go by, but we're going to go by the coupling of the axion to the gauge fields. And the size of these couplings is what dictates how strongly those different sectors are reheated. So this is a very...
You're assuming the reheat time is charged under all of the K sectors.
It's not charged. It's not charged. It's an axion that couples to GG dual. Yeah, exactly. So, right, some people are studying cases, I think, where you could have a charged reheat ton under some sector, and that might answer the question of why you reheat one rather than many, right? So this is a very important subject in post-inflationary cosmology. In string theory, we often do inflation, and we do standard model physics, and sort of ignore things in between. But this is a critical aspect to post-inflationary cosmology, which we actually know a good bit about. So there are potential problems that arise at large n. So for instance, if many of these gauge sectors are confining, in the simplest case, if they were pure Yang mills, you could compute the relic abundance in these sectors, and you can produce too much dark matter. So one of the ways out, if you had one of the ways out of this issue where you reheat all of these sectors, would be if there were some reason to expect some non-trivial distribution of couplings that would cause certain sectors to be reheated rather than others. But that sounds like a hard thing, and it requires really doing some computation. So you can't just argue that by fiat. Yeah. Okay, so this is the setup. We have a way of doing this in F theory with some axion effective field theories. The geometric data are some the volume of the overall base of the elliptic vibration, ratios of curve volumes, because we're in a threefold d alpha intersect d beta, the intersection of two divisors is a curve. That curve can have some volume divided by the volumes of the divisors themselves. And so there's this geometric data that's topological intersections plus volumes of the overall manifold divisors and curves that's via a rather long machine, you can canonically normalize, choose to compute these couplings, etc. And what you get at the end of the day, in our ensemble at least, is a picture that looks something like this. So, pardon?
What was the reheat time in that model?
Sorry, in this case, we're considering axions. So it could be other things. We're considering the case that it's axions.
Okay.
In this picture, yes. Really, what we should say is what we're really doing is we're computing the distribution of couplings of axions to various different gauge sectors, and under the ansatz that the axion is the reheaton, that would be give potential decay channels into the various different gauge sectors.
So the implicon is some particular linear combination?
That's what we have in the back of our minds. We're not identifying which one it is. We're studying the possibilities. Yeah. So like, if you had axion inflation, you might ask, how am I going to end axion inflation and reheat different gauge sectors? And you could imagine going through these axion GG dual couplings. Yeah. So maybe in the interest of time, I'll just sort of state what the result is. So each one of these lines here is a single geometry. And so if you had a probability distribution that looked like that, and then you turned it on its face and turned it into a heat map, each one of these lines would be a single geometry. And what this is basically what's happening in these plots is that the case of totally democratic symmetric reheating would be the case where the peak of the probability distribution is up here at zero. But the peak is actually the bright part of the plot. And every line is a given geometry. So the peak is the bright part of the plot. And that's saying that what's very common is that you end up in situations where you're actually not reheating all of the gauge sectors. We have two different ansatzes that I can tell people more about if they're interested. In a case where you take random linear combinations, the result is not quite as strong. You're definitely up closer towards zero. But the upshot is that given this ansatz, you're coupling to 1% of the gauge sectors, and given the ansatz on the other side, you have order one coupling to 10% of the gauge sectors. So this could potentially partially solve some of the reheating problems that could arise in string theory. And it again depends on assumptions and exactly which linear combination in a given setup you're going to identify as the inflaton, but this is the structure. This is, to my knowledge, the first study of asymmetric reheating in a big string ensemble, and what we find is that it's plausible that you don't reheat all of the gauge sectors. But I want to ask some G2 questions. So if one wanted to do this in G2 construction, so I asked, first of all, these questions about singularities in G2 spaces and whether these non-Higgsable clusters arise. If you wanted to do these sorts of axion calculations, first of all, you would need to know the Kähler potential, which is this particular function of the overall volume of the G2 manifold. You would need geometric couplings to the gauge sectors. So there are a whole bunch of M3s, three manifolds in the G2 space that carry ADE singularities, and you would need to know how the complexified G2 moduli are coupling to those, which is going to require some intersection theory. And then you would need a way to sample G2 moduli space. Okay. So I'm basically out of time, so I want to make one more point and then finish. So there's another result that is interesting that is not mine at all that I also want to ask in a G2 context. So Mehmet Demirtas, Cody Long, Liam McAllister, and Mike Stillman had this result from last fall, where basically they studied Calabi-Yau manifolds at large H11. And what they were able to show is that what happens at large H11, if you demand not that you're just in the Kähler cone, where the volume of all of the holomorphic curves is greater than or equal to zero, but that you're in a stretched Kähler cone, where the volume of all of the holomorphic curves is greater than or equal to one, so that you can roughly ignore worldsheet instanton corrections. What happens is that they find this sort of scissor effect that is physically pretty interesting. So these, in the picture on the left, these are the walls of the Kähler cone. The stretched Kähler cone is the thing in white, and the thing that is in the part of the Kähler cone that's not in the stretched Kähler cone is this red structure. And what they find is being in this stretched Kähler cone, at large n, as they move to larger and larger H11, the Kähler cones tend to narrow. And what happens when the Kähler cones tend to narrow is it forces you to large volume, and you should expect extremely light axions. So the way that they estimate the axion masses in these cases is that it's e to the minus 2 pi tau last, where tau last is the biggest volume divisor in their Calabi-Yaus. And what they end up with is a case where they have axions that are 10 to the minus 300 EV and even smaller. And this is a picture where this forced narrowing of the Kähler cone, of the stretched Kähler cone at large n, is giving rise to ultralight axions that are effectively massless from the point of view of cosmology. So in G2 context, I put it in quotes, the analog of sort of a stretched Kähler cone would be some sort of stretched G2 cone, where you consider the space of three forms, of possible G2 forms phi and H3 of x, and you want to consider some sort of analog of the volume of the holomorphic curves being greater than or equal to 1, and this the natural thing here is the volume of some associatives greater than or equal to 1. And what they're finding is that the Kähler cone is becoming more and more narrow at large H11. The G2 question would be, does this object become more and more narrow at large B3 for G2 manifolds? And if so, then M2 instanton contributions to the axion mass would be very, very, very light. And what you have is a picture emerging that at large n, the structure of these stretch Kähler cones, which are nice things, or this potential stretch G2 cone would force you very far out in the moduli space and give you a situation where you have very, very light axions. Okay, so I'm out of time, so I will finish there. Just to say, the conclusions are that there are large gauge sectors and numbers of axions that are expected in Calabi-Yau compactifications, at least at large n. So if cosmology is selecting anything like that, we should expect large gauge sectors and large numbers of axions. There are consequences for real-world physics, and in G2 ensembles at large n, by which I mean large B3, do we expect similar sorts of things to arise? So this is my final slide to leave up sort of all of the questions I asked in case there's a comment related to them. So thanks a lot. And sorry that it was so physics-y. Hopefully I at least asked some G2 questions.
Yeah, could you go back to the slide where you defined axions in a G2 setting?
Yes.
So you want to integrate over some associatives, you say, and still get a one form on the base, is that correct?
Zero form.
Zero form now.
Yes, I'm integrating a three form over a three cycle.
Okay, so it looked like you had one forms in the Calabi-Yau setting.
Oh, apologies if I made a mistake. I might have.
The theta is a scalar,
yeah? Yeah. I shouldn't write it. Technically, I shouldn't write it as a wedge product. Yeah, theta is a scalar. It's a zero form, and omega is a p form. So when I integrate the higher p form gauge field over the p cycle in the extra dimensions, I end up with a scalar in 4D.
Okay, so that's.
Yeah. Sorry for the confusion. Yeah.
Other questions? Sebastian, more precisely, explain to us slightly more precisely, the space of axions in from a G2 compactification is H upper 3 with U1 coefficients.
Bobby, where does the U1 come from again in that case? There's some symmetry that...
It's H upper 3 with real coefficients, which is the third cohomology group. Uh-huh. But then you have to quotient by the integral cohomology group because of the global gauge transformation. Those are the global gauge transformations.
Got it. So when you quotient by those gauge transformations that I wrote up there, you're pointing out that really they're living in a space with U1 coefficient.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
But so... Maybe, you know the slide where you have the big numbers?
Yeah, sure. I have a number of slides like
that. The one where you explain, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
So here you're saying this is a construction of like 10 to the 755 compact elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau fourfolds, right?
That exist in a big connected Calabi-Yau moduli space.
And then you say that number, most of them have these non-Higgsable gauge groups.
Yes, and we have in our papers, we have precise statements on lower bounds and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's amazing.
Maybe one thing that I should say that might motivate a G2 crowd. Sorry, was your question?
Carry on.
Yeah. So one of the things that we believe is special about what we're doing at F-theory and also in G2 is that we're moving away from weakly coupled limits of the theory. So in these geometries, there's a particular type of limit in complex structure moduli space for these elliptic vibrations called a Senn limit, where the theory becomes weakly coupled. In this ensemble, we were actually able to show that almost none of them have a Senn limit also. So these are strongly coupled theories where there is no weakly coupled limit in the moduli space. So if you'd like, it's giving some motivation that F-theory really is a pretty big generalization of 2B from the point of view of these bases, at least. And maybe so, something's true of G2 also, similarly.
So just to motivate people thinking about G2, so you would maybe conjecture based on this that a generic G2 manifold has lots of codimension 4 singularities. I mean, a generic G-comp G2 space.
You should not use the word manifold.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. Some G2 space with lots of different 3 manifolds, each of which has an ADE singularity.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. That would be the natural G2 analog of the physics that we see emerging in this other context. I realize that that's a big ask to like say that I want to know the answer to that question, but that's something that we see arising that I think is physically relevant in F-theory. And I don't see any reason it shouldn't happen in G2 also.
Is it totally obvious, though? I mean, what if you summed up all the non-perturbative effects?
You weren't here yesterday. We have to wait for the microphone.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so here it's like what the F-theory kind of, if you like, classical geometry.
Yeah.
Now, if you summed over all of the non-perturbative effects, how much of that stuff is actually going to survive by the time you're done? So in other words, if you're a four-dimensional low-energy observer,
yes.
They don't know whether they came from F-theory or G2, let's say.
Yeah, right.
Maybe all of that non-perturbative stuff has been summed over and it just...
Or heterotic.
Yeah, so
I got no problem with that.
So one way of phrasing your question is, if this doesn't happen in G2, which it could not happen in G2, it could be that I'm only considering part of the F-theory data. And when you really consider all of it, which has technicalities that are important associated with it, that secretly summing up all the non-perturbative effects, turning on flux and everything, at low energies, you're getting rid of these things. But that's an open question. Yeah.
Bobby says it's hard to believe.
Supported on a rational homology sphere, then you know basically the gauge group has a factor in it which is pure Supiang-Mills theory. That's a non-abelian gauge theory that confines in the infrared. There's no matter that can Higgs that at all. It doesn't couple to anything else. So that's going to be there. And basically, I mean, most of these gauge group factors are pure Supiang-Mills.
Well, yeah, but you're assuming that the volume of that 3 manifold.
Wait, where'd you get the other one?
There too.
Oh. But in that context, you're assuming that the volume of that three manifold is rather big, right? So I guess what I'm asking is, how do we know that the parameter space of the F-theory model, where we're assuming big four-cycle volumes, maps onto the big three-manifold volume limit? That seems to be the implicit assumption here.
I am imagining that, right, so the question about large three-manifold and large divisor is really a question, if the matter is such that the theory will confine, it's a question of the confinement scale, right? So it's not a question of big or large. There's sort of the matter question, which is the question of whether the one-loop beta function is positive or negative. But what the confinement scale is depends critically on these ideas. And definitely, John, I mean, I completely agree that one of the things you'll get in these setups is confined things where at low energies it looks like there is no gauge group and there's some spectrum of dark blue balls or hadrons that can have cosmological consequences.
But also the different F-theory or heterotic or G2 give lots of predictions for the world that you will get from them, and they're different, so they're not going to end up being summed over, and we're going to actually live in one of them.
That's right. So I would actually I would imagine it's more like that. But basically, each one is kind of like got a particular corner of moduli space that it's good at describing, and then those might produce different low energy effects.
Yeah. So you're imagining that G2 might not produce something like this.
I don't know.
You're posing the question.
Yeah. G2 might produce something and the others might not.
But I think you agree, for instance, if it produced something like pure super Young Mills, right, then it is going to confine, first of all. It's going to be non-Higgsable, and the confinement scale is going to depend on the volume of the three manifold.
Sure.
Yeah. So I agree. Yeah. So we don't know the answer in G2. I'm just trying to ask the question in some sense, because we do see it in F-theory. It may be that it doesn't carry through.
I mean, the volumes have to be moderately large in order to explain the value of Newton's constant and alpha. So.
Well, that's the value of the 7.
Well, alpha. No, the value of alpha is the volume of a three manifold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So the observed alpha, I agree, but we're talking about, like, I don't know, however many, 2.96 times whatever, giant number minus order one.
Right.
So who knows what the value of alpha is in all those things?
Well, and in particular, on any given base, there will be a Kähler moduli space, and alpha is the dark gauge coupling for you? That's what we're talking about?
No, it's alpha.
The dark gauge coupling.
The actual alpha.
Yeah. Oh, the actual alpha
one over
electromagnetism.
137, right?
Right. I have not tried to engineer standard models here, so I will not comment on alpha EM.
So that's one data point we for sure have. But
absolutely.
I think the question is, like, how generic is the lesson for, like, all the dark stuff?
About alpha dark.
Well, it would be a bit strange if, I mean, you could imagine very asymmetric G2 manifolds where, like, all of, you know, many of the three cycles are small, but then the standard model one is much bigger. But that doesn't seem reasonable. I mean, I would somehow think
this is a great discussion. I see expressions in the mathematicians in the room which indicate that there is some confusion about what you all are talking about. I would like to suggest that maybe some of these things should be explained in the next 5 minutes by somebody, or else we can have a private conversation. There's also a discussion on the calendar today, maybe two on the calendar today. Yes, perfect. So let's adjourn to coffee. There's a talk at 10:20, and please remember to wear your badge if possible.